Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I apologize for Radha's not being with us this evening. It was a great disappointment to all of us. I am going to talk this evening on the subject which she gave us. However, she didn't give me her talk. So consequently, you must not hold Radha responsible for anything you hear this evening. The subject Radha announced was order, freedom, and the law of karma. In 1882, one of Madame Blavatsky's teachers, whom we call the Master K.H., wrote a long letter to an Englishman then living in India, whose name was A.P. Sinnett. In this letter, the writer, K.H., made what I think is a remarkable statement. He said this: "You can do no better than to study the two doctrines of karma and nirvana as profoundly as you can, unless you are thoroughly well acquainted with the two tenets. You will always find yourself at sea in trying to comprehend the rest." Now, I wonder, of all of the teachings of the ancient wisdom, why did K.H. name these two, karma and nirvana, as central ones? Another teacher of Madame Blavatsky's, whom we call the Master M, wrote in another letter, contrasting what he called the mystery of nirvana with the objective existence which we pass out of when we attain the state of Buddhahood. The sphere of objective existence is, of course, the field in which karma operates. We are here in this world, smack dab in the condition of objective existence, a condition governed by karma. And you and I expect, are likely to remain here for a while before finally such time arrives as we attain the state of Buddhahood and pass into nirvana. So it is perhaps appropriate that we should make karma governing this state our profound study. To be sure, karma may seem very old hat to us. We know all about it, don't we? The word karma, as a matter of fact, was introduced into common use in the West by theosophists. There is a great dictionary of the English language called the Oxford English Dictionary. This dictionary, in its current version, consists of 20 volumes, and not little volumes, these are big volumes. And this dictionary traces the history of every English word from its entry into the English language until the present day. If one looks up the word karma in that dictionary, you will find that it first appeared in English in some technical writing, such as the Transactions of the Royal Asiatic Society and some other scholarly descriptions of Buddhism and Hinduism. But the first general use of the word karma in English was by A.P. Sinnett in his first theosophical book entitled The Occult World. And the first recorded use by anyone of the adjective karmic was also by A.P. Sinnett in his second book, Esoteric Buddhism. So successful was the theosophical importation of the word karma that it has come to be used throughout the Western world, often in rather surprising ways. A few years ago, there was a comic strip, which some of the Americans in the audience may know, called Foxtrot. This newspaper comic strip showed two boys playing a board game that involved rolling dice. One boy, whose turn it was to roll the dice, was taking a long time to shake them. And as he did so, he was saying, "Come on, seven. Big seven. Come on, seven, 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 seven." And the other boy, who grew impatient at the delay, said urgently, "Just roll." And the first boy replied, "Please, you're messing with my karma." Who were teaching a calm and meditative way to drive automobiles in the hope of curbing and counteracting the impatience and sometimes violence one finds on the highways these days. The newspaper article quoted them. "Be a Buddha behind the wheel," they implored drivers who are tempted to behave more like road Rambos and disturb the good karma on the freeway. Well, karma is now an ordinary, everyday word in the English language, used by people who have little or no knowledge of its origin in Hinduism and Buddhism, in Indic religions, or in theosophy. But theosophists, in fact, began that ordinary use. Since we theosophists have a kind of claim on the word karma in Western use, and perhaps a responsibility for that use, we think we know all about it. Karma, we know, is the law of compensation, the law of retribution, the law of reward and punishment. But if that's all we know about karma, perhaps we don't know so very much after all. Annie Besant, the second international president of the society, said that theosophy is a sea with shallows in which a child may wade safely and depths in which even a giant must swim. There's nothing wrong with a view of karma as a law of reward and punishment. In a sense, it is that. But that view of karma is milk for babes. It is a Santa Claus view of karma, is something that knows when we've been good or bad, so we should be good for heaven's sakes, as an English Christmas song goes. But there are mysteries about karma, complexities that entice us out of the shallows and into the depths of the theosophical sea. Here we can only glance briefly at two aspects of this deeper mystery, and they are the relationship of karma to order and freedom. Remember the title which Mrs. Bournier chose was Freedom, Order, and the Law of Karma. So first I want to say a few words about karma as order. The first of the deeper and mysterious aspects of karma is the question of whether the idea of karma as moral order is in fact confirmed by our experience. The idea of karma as moral order, put simply, is that when we do right, good results. And when we do wrong, evil follows. It is a comforting assurance that if we will just behave ourselves, nothing unpleasant will ever happen to us. But do we, in fact, find that comforting assurance to be true in our personal lives or in our observation of the lives of others? What about the gangsters and tyrants who, at least to all appearances, end their lives in comfort and satisfaction? That is, who are rewarded despite wrong actions. Well, to be sure, we might suppose that the appearances are wrong and that the rascals were really tormented in ways we cannot see, or else that they will get their comeuppance in future lives. But then, what about all the victims of earthquakes and tornadoes, of ethnic cleansings and terrorism? it is difficult to suppose that their appearance of suffering is illusory, or that they have all had secret sins or past life wickedness that merited their dreadful experiences. In fact, a simple view of the principle of karma as moral order, rewarding well-doing and punishing ill-doing, does not get much support from our observation of the world. Certainly, the Old Testament Job did not find such a principle operating in his life. Well, then, is the principle of karma wrong? Or have we simply gotten out of our depths by thinking about it in a shallow way? If we're going to think deeply about the doctrine of karma, we must recognize a complementary doctrine, namely that of fields of karma. But what do we mean by a field of karma? Perhaps that concept can be best explained with a parable. Let us suppose that I am very fond of Indian food, especially hot curries. And the hotter they are, the fonder I am of them. Now I eat a delicious meal of spicy curry. And then a little afterwards, my stomach begins to complain because it's aching terribly. Let us suppose that my stomach can talk. What might it say? It might say something like this: why do I have these terrible pains? I've done nothing wrong. I've only done what I'm supposed to do. I've dutifully digested the foods that were given to me. But just because I have acted rightly and done my duty, I am plagued by this bellyache. It's all the fault of that rascal tongue, which likes hot curries. Why should I have to suffer for the tongue's desires? There is no justice in the world. And then the tongue might reply, well, yes, it's true, I wanted the curry. But I'm also suffering because the curry burned me and left a terrible aftertaste. And it's not really my fault. Even though I wanted the curry, I didn't do anything to get it. The hand put it in my mouth. It's all the fault of the hand. That rascally hand is not suffering at all, despite the evil deed it did. I agree, there's no justice in the world. And then the hand might answer, don't blame it all on me. I was only doing what I was ordered to do. I got no pleasure out of the tongue's tasting or the stomach's digesting that curry. I am an innocent bystander who only does what is required of me. It is certainly unjust to blame me for the pain that others may feel. Indeed, there is no justice in the world. Well, are the stomach, the tongue, and the hand right about the lack of justice in their world? Or are they wrong because their field of vision is too narrow? What we might call the field of eating is not limited to the hand, which puts food into the mouth, or the tongue, which tastes it, or the stomach, which digests it. Hand, tongue, and stomach, each has its role in the total process or field of eating. But that field includes many other organs also: the teeth, the gullet, the intestines, the blood, the arteries and veins, the heart, the nerves, the brain, the muscles, and so on. The field of eating is the whole body, each of whose parts has some role in the process. As the field of eating is the whole body, with its various organs involved in various ways, so the results of eating influence the whole body, affecting each of its organs in various ways. In an analogous way, you and I are not separate, isolated entities who are independent of one another in our actions. The first principle of theosophy,
whether we think of the first object of the society, which Ruth Ann quoted, to form a nucleus of the universal brotherhood of humanity, or whether we think of the first of the three fundamental propositions of the secret doctrine, which is that there is only one ultimate reality. The first principle of theosophy is that there is ultimately only one life in the universe. All apparently separate beings are sharers in that one life. There is only one field of life. Consequently, what any of us does affects, in some measure, all of the rest of us. The sharing of our actions, and consequently also the results of our actions, was referred to by H.P. Blavatsky in her book, The Key to Theosophy, under the term distributive karma. This is what she said. It is held as a truth among theosophists that the interdependence of humanity is the cause of what is called distributive karma. And it is this law which affords the solution to the great question of collective suffering and its relief. It is an occult, that is to say, a hidden law, moreover, that no man can rise superior to his individual failings without lifting, be it ever so little, the whole body of which he is an integral part. In the same way, no one can sin or suffer the effects of sin alone. In reality, there is no such thing as separateness. I'm going to depart from my text. This will throw the translators into a tizzy. They're in a room upstairs. But simply to observe that this statement which I have just read, ending with, in reality, there is no such thing as separateness, strikes me as being remarkably apposite, appropriate to political events in the United States at the present time. Distributive karma, as Blavatsky called it, refers to actions whose results are distributed over various parts of a whole, that whole being the field of karma for those particular actions. The fact that all human beings make up one field of karma was clearly stated by Blavatsky's teachers in letters from which she quoted in her 1889 message to the Convention of the American Society. She wrote, quoting her teachers, "Let not the fruit of good karma be your motive. For your karma, good or bad, being one and the common property of all mankind, nothing good or bad can happen to you that is not shared by many others. Would you be partakers of divine wisdom or true theosophists? Then do as the gods when incarnated do. Feel yourselves the vehicles of the whole humanity, mankind as part of yourself, and act accordingly." Although there are smaller local fields of karma that embrace a single person in a single lifetime, or a single individual as that individual is incarnated in many persons over many lifetimes, there are greater fields of karma as well. Family karma, community karma, national karma may be easily recognized. But there is also a field of karma for all human beings, a species karma, as well as fields of karma for the whole planet with all its lives, for the solar system, the Milky Way, our supergalaxy, and finally the great cosmos itself in all of its immensity and variety. There is one reality, one life, and that is the ultimate field of karma. The idea that karma is not limited to one incarnation, to one personality, but is shared over many incarnations of the same individual, is well known in theosophical circles and is indeed one of the main, if I think somewhat shallow, reasons for the widespread acceptance of the idea of karma. However, just as our personalities are not separate from one another, but are all connected as expressions of the same reincarnating individuality, so also we as individualities are not separate from one another either. Our individualities are all expressions of the same unity, the same monad, the same single consciousness. And just as the field of our personal karma is encompassed by a larger field of our individual karma, so is our individual karma encompassed by greater fields of karma, stretching over all of the groups of which we are a part, right up to the greatest of all such groups, which consists of all beings, everywhere, and at all times. This fact I have attempted to diagram at the top of the handout, which you may have had, the notion being that the world soul embracing all life in the universe and everything which depends from it is a single field of karma. But then each of the kingdoms of nature constitutes another field of karma, the human among them. And within the human field of karma, each of us as individuals, reincarnating individuals, are our own smaller fields of karma. And finally, even within this lifetime, our personality is a field of karma. Karma is indeed the principle of order. But it is order that applies not merely to you and me in our limited personal selves. As H.P.B. says in The Key to Theosophy, karma is the ultimate law of the universe, the source, origin, and fount of all other laws which exist throughout nature. It is the ultimate principle of order. Well, what about karma as freedom? The second of the deeper and mysterious aspects of karma is the question of whether karma allows any scope for free action. If, as William Quan Judge, one of our other founding members, said in his Aphorisms on Karma, karma is undeviating and unerring and operates incessantly. If that is true, is there then any possibility for the options and the uncertainty that free will and choice demand? If we are to have a real choice, there must be alternatives to choose among. Everything cannot be fixed by the past. There must be also an uncertainty as to which choice we will make. The future cannot be fully predictable. But the idea of a universal law, which karma is said to be, is precisely that it will predict with certainty. I can remember, as a matter of fact, myself, as a young theosophist, you might not think I could remember that long ago, but I can, being mightily puzzled by this question. If every cause has an unavoidable effect, and that effect in turn becomes another cause for a succeeding effect, it looks as though all of life is predetermined by whatever cause operated first. Everything that has ever been or that ever will be would seem to be the direct or indirect result of the first action in the cosmos. And that would mean that I have no freedom. And yet the philosopher, the great philosopher and president of India, S. Radhakrishnan, wrote this: freedom and karma are two aspects of the same reality. It is, as the king of Siam was wont to say, a puzzlement. This puzzlement, like the first one, is perhaps the result of wading in the shallows. Its solution is a little further out in the depths. The solution involves recognizing that we are spiritually amphibious creatures. We exist simultaneously in two worlds. One of those worlds is the world in which karma is the fundamental natural law. That is the world which in Indian tradition is called, particularly Buddhist tradition, is called samsara, the world of objective existence, of birth and death, of cause and effect. The other world is that of nirvana. And nirvana is not governed by karma, but by a different law, namely dharma. Now, the word dharma means many things in Sanskrit, but here we can contrast it with the word karma. The word karma, and I now will refer you to the bottom of the handout where much of what I'm going to say is in list form. The word karma comes from a root meaning to make or to form. It is what we do in this world of becoming. The word dharma comes from a root meaning to hold or to support. It is what we are in the world of beingness. Karma is fate, what we have made for ourselves in the past. Dharma is destiny, what awaits us in the future. Karma is old and closed. Dharma is new and open. Karma pushes us. Dharma calls us. Karma is the conditioning of our personality and the cause of our material circumstances. Dharma is the spontaneity of our individuality and the purpose of our spiritual lives. Karma comes from our human ego. Dharma from our divine selves. Karma forms the skandhas, the dispositions to respond of our lower self and our temperament. Dharma is the emanation of character from what Blavatsky called our ajiyades, our golden or shining self, or higher self. Karma provides limitations. Dharma, possibilities. Karma is horizontal. Dharma is vertical. Karma is what St. Paul called the law. Dharma is what he called grace. Karma operates in the world of maya or illusion. Dharma derives from the world of satya or truth. Karma is inertial and actual. Dharma, creative and potential. Karma creates the network and hierarchy of our lives. Dharma is the principle of holarchy or undivided unity. We must, as the Master K.H. told us, study and become well acquainted with the doctrine of karma, for it governs the samsaric world of objective existence in which we now live. But we must equally study and become as thoroughly well acquainted as we can with the doctrine of nirvana, for that is the world of truth, goodness, and beauty, of Satchitananda, beingness, awareness, and joy, and it is our true home. Because we are in reality beings of a realm where all separateness and selfishness, all ignorance and grasping, all limitations and conditionings have been blown out. The word nirvana means blown out. We are beings of light, of love, and of liberty. Freedom is essential to our nature. What then is our relation to this conditioned world of objective existence? The world of samsara and karma is, as it were, a multidimensional web spread out before us. Its dimensions are the familiar ones of space, of time, but also, theosophy says, of planes, that is to say, of different varieties, different levels, just different constitutions of matter and of possibilities. It is a world of intersecting alternative realities. Many scientists, many physicists today are talking about alternative worlds beside the world in which we live. And this is precisely the theosophical idea. Each of the alternatives of this world of samsara is a fully determined, conditioned pattern of life. But there are more of those alternative patterns than we can count. There is not one world of samsara, but uncountably many such worlds, all existing here and now in a labyrinth or maze of possibilities. As we travel through the karmic maze of samsara, we are constrained, we are forced to follow the path before us. But we come repeatedly to branchings in that path, alternatives that open before us. And although the whole labyrinth is fixed and determined, our choice of which path we will follow inside the maze is not determined. We select it. Our essential nature is the trinity of Atma Buddhi Manas. Atma is will, that is, free choice, by which we can thread out our way through the labyrinth of samsara. Buddhi is the discriminative wisdom that we need to make our choices at the crossroads. And Manas is the mindful awareness by which we carry out that choice. We find ourselves in the labyrinthine world of samsara, the world of karma, the world of empirical mind, desire, conditioning, and limited forms. But we really belong to the world of nirvana, the world of dharma, which holds and supports, the world of free will, of discriminative wisdom, and mindful attention. Why then did Radhakrishnan say that freedom and karma are two aspects of the same reality? The answer to that question, I believe, is easy. Nirvana and samsara, as the Buddhists tell us, are not two places. They are one. They differ only from the standpoint of how we look at them. There is, the first fundamental proposition of the sacred doctrine tells us, only one ultimate reality. Nirvana is nowhere, and samsara is now here. But they differ only in how we divide them. That's a spelling pun, which works, alas, only in English. I'm sorry, I apologize to all of the Spanish and Portuguese speakers, but the English word nowhere is spelled N-O-W-H-E-R-E, and now here is N-O-W-H-E-R-E. So the difference is only in where we make the division between the two. As Arjuna learned in the Bhagavad Gita, true freedom comes from following one's own dharma, because that dharma is one's own essential nature. Having realized our dharma, knowing who we really are, we know how we should act in all circumstances. We know our karma. Dharma and karma are then, in one sense, also the same. Freedom is the freedom to act as we will, we being the real we, the Atma within us. And so freedom and karma are indeed two aspects of the same and only reality. Now, what has all of this got to do with daily living? When the Master K.H. urged the profound study of the two doctrines of karma and nirvana, he was not, I think, recommending a merely intellectual enterprise. An understanding of these two principles is of immense importance for successful living. To live a productive and happy life, we need two things two things which are even more important than food and shelter. First, we need a confidence that the universe is an orderly and just place. Despite whatever experiences we may have from time to time of disorder and injustice, we need to know that the whole is governed by order and justice. And that's what karma tells us. Second, we need the assurance that we are not merely automata, conditioned beings who have no options. Despite whatever restrictions and limitations we may from time to time encounter, we need to know that we have freedom of choice, the freedom to be ourselves. That confidence and assurance are our guarantees of the promise in a little book written by Blavatsky called The Voice of the Silence, in which she says, "Thou canst create this day thy chances for thy morrow." We can create our tomorrow today. We can make our own future. We can make ourselves. With the assurance of a just order in the world all around us and of our freedom to act, we can live productively in this world of samsara and karma, which is at the same time the world of nirvana and dharma. William Butler Yeats, the Anglo-Irish poet who was a student of H.P. Blavatsky's, once said, "Eternity is in love with the productions of time." There is no conflict between the eternity of nirvana and the time of samsara. The Indian god Shiva dances the cosmos into and out of existence from sheer joy. We do not reach nirvana by withdrawing from the world of samsara, but rather by living fully in it. Nirvana and karma are not contraries, nor are freedom and order. They are all aspects of the same reality. The Voice of the Silence makes that point in memorable and inspiring words, which are fitting ones with which to end this brief glance at the relationship between karma, order, and freedom. In that book, we read, "Shalt thou abstain from action? Not so shall gain thy soul her freedom. To reach nirvana, one must reach self-knowledge, and self-knowledge is of loving deeds the child." Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
For those of you who might have questions to ask, if you could just come up to the mic and then others just form a line right there.
John, if I understand you correctly, you said we carry our karma from life to life. Do we carry our personality also from life to life?
I don't think I need to repeat that question because Spanish and Portuguese speakers will have heard it, I think, translated. It is a theosophical tradition and belief. For those of you who may be in the audience who are not theosophists, let me explain something first. Theosophy is basically a non-dogmatic movement, so that although there are certain traditions of theosophical thought, ideas which are shared by many theosophists, and indeed probably by most theosophists, it's not a case of any theosophist having to believe anything. Consequently, every time I say what theosophists think, what I'm really saying is what I think, or what I think a good many other theosophists think, but it's not a statement of universal belief. It is, however, a theosophical tradition that our personalities as such do not survive long the death of the body. When the body dies, the personality, some echoes of it may hang around for a while, may remain for a while, but they do not long remain. The personality dissipates with the death of the body, partly because the personality is obviously very closely associated with the body, right? Our body is very influential on our personalities. We're very much entwined. The way we think, the way we feel, the way we respond is very much hooked up with this physical form. So when that physical form disappears, so do those personality traits associated with it. But it's also theosophical tradition that something remains. And these are often called by a term borrowed from Buddhism, the skandhas. And skandhas are dispositions to respond in certain ways. They are seeds, as it were, of a new personality. And obviously they reflect the old personality. So when a new baby is born, its personality is formed by a variety of factors, according to theosophical thinking. Some of those factors are ones which are generally recognized in society as a whole. Obviously, babies are influenced by the genetic inheritance from their parents, right? Obviously, you know, they look like mother, father, not just look, but will acquire behavioral characteristics genetically. That's clearly the case. It is true. But also, they are very much influenced by the environment, right, in which they grow up, especially by the other kids, the other children they grow up with. So, yes, nature and nurture, inheritance and environment are two extraordinarily important factors in forming a new personality, but Theosophists believe that they are not the only two. Theosophists believe that there is something else. There is a third factor which comes in. And that factor is one which is not normally recognized by society at large. I'll tell a little story here, which some of you have heard, but a good many of you have not. I had a good friend who was a professor of linguistics at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. His name was Kenneth Pike. He was a very interesting man. He was very active in the Wycliffe Bible Translating Society. And they trained missionaries to go out all over the world and to record languages of primitive peoples which had no written form. And, of course, the purpose of this recording of the language was to translate scripture, the Christian scriptures, into them for purposes of conversion. He was a remarkable man in many, many ways. But I once heard him tell a story about his daughter. He had a daughter of whom he was very, very fond. And on one occasion, she did something which was very naughty. And he was extremely angry with her. And he scolded her. And he read her, what we call in English, he read her the riot act. He just berated her. And when he got done, she looked up at him with eyes that only a daughter can have for a father. I speak as a father of a daughter. She looked up at him with those daughterly eyes and said to him, "Oh, Daddy, I'm so sorry. I don't know what made me do it. Which do you suppose it was, environment or heredity?" Well, she thought she had him, right? Because he had supplied both of those things. So it wasn't her fault, it was his. She was practicing the game of the stomach, the tongue, and the hand, right? Blame somebody else. I don't know what he told her. He never finished the story. He never said what he responded to her. But my daughter never tried that with me. But I know what I would have told her. Neither environment nor heredity, it's the skandhas. In a theosophical tradition, we bring over from past lives certain dispositions to respond that help to create our new personality. So the personality as such doesn't carry over, but certain seeds or tendencies carry over from one personality to another.
Thank you. I have a question.
Could you say it, and I'll say it aloud, and then we'll let them translate it.
On your hand, Doc, can you define the difference between individuality and personality?
Yeah.
I'd like to see
that. Yeah, sure. The question was, on the handout, at the top of the handout, it says personality and it says individuality. And what's the difference between them? That's a bit of theosophical jargon. You know, every group has got its own jargon, its own special language, its own terminology. And it's inevitable. A distinction has been made in theosophical literature since, as a matter of fact, the 1880s, it's very old, between personality and individuality. And the personality is this one lifetime, right? As I know myself right now in this body, I have a personality. But I have a strong sense that that personality is not all there is to me. There is something else. When this personality, when this body dies and the personality dissipates, there is something which goes on, not just those skandhas which are passed on. There is something which has caused that personality to come into existence. And that thing which has caused the personality to come into existence, we call the individuality. Now, in speaking about this, we must always use metaphors. There is no other way to talk about important things than poetry, than metaphors. Theosophists frequently use a kind of metaphor for this, which has its virtues, but also has its weaknesses. It's perhaps on the shallow side of the pond, not the deep end. That metaphor is that it is like you and me when we go to bed at night. We take off our clothes, we take off our outer garments, we take off our daytime wear, get into bed, go to sleep, and when we wake up the next morning, we put on a clean, new set of garments. Well, the set of garments is like the body. It's like the body which we are born into. And we are like the sleeper. And sleep is the death period. That metaphor has its weaknesses. There's another metaphor which I prefer, which I think actually is closer to the real theosophical view, and that is that the individuality is like the sun in the heavens. And the sun can get, the sunlight can get focused through a lens on a little pile of wood chips and shaving. And if you focus the light of the sun on a little pile of wood chip and shavings, what happens? It bursts into flame. It bursts into fire. Well, I would suggest that little chip, that little pile of chip and shavings is the physical body. The fire which it springs from it is the life energy of a given lifetime. But the sun is the individuality. It's the thing which causes it. It does not descend. It does not incarnate. It doesn't come really into the body at all. Rather, it causes the personality and the life of the body to exist. But it's always in the heavens, never having descended. Nirvana is its home.